In 2023, baseball's best pitchers are focused, extremely driven, athletic paragons. But in the first decade of the 20th century, baseball's best pitcher was an unpredictable eccentric who disappeared in the middle of games, got into fights, spent all his money on booze, and was obsessed with fire engines, which makes Randall Lodowitz wonder,
why is this not a movie?
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Not a Movie, the podcast where we look at a moment in history or a book or a story we can riff from the headlines and ask Hollywood why no one's ever put it onto the big screen. I'm Mike Vago, and with me this week is Randall Lodowitz, author of the DC Book of Lists, Superhero Playbook, Lessons in Life from Your Favorite Superheroes, Michael Recycle, and the Mini Book of Mini Darts, a book that comes with a playable dartboard, and is close to my heart because it's a spiritual sibling to my own book, The Miniature Book of Miniature Golf, a playable mini golf course in book form. Just had to plug myself while I was plugging you. Randall's also an editor at Running Press, who focuses on film, TV, and comic-related projects. Thanks for coming on the show. Tell us about Rube Waddell and why his story needs to be a movie.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. And I'm excited to talk about Rube Waddell because I've just never seen someone quite like him before. It's one of those times where I stumbled across something on Wikipedia and just fell down the rabbit hole. And I was obsessed with this person who's larger than life. I'm not even a sports person, let alone a baseball person. Sports and me never clicked because, like my day job interests, I liked comics, film, TV. But just the fact that someone like this existed, and I kept having to click sources to make sure what I was reading was just not someone having a field day on Wikipedia. So let's start. Rube Waddell, real name George Edward Waddell, was born in 1886. He was a Major League Baseball player for 13 seasons, renowned left-handed pitcher. And he was eccentric since he's a young boy. One of the earliest things they mention is that when he was 3 years old, he wandered off to a local fire station and stayed there for 3 days. Did his parents go get him? I don't know. I want to find out. Did they just say he'll be fine there?
Also, I just feel like, you know, we all know like parents relaxed in the 70s. Just extrapolate that another 100 years.
I know. I mean, I'm sure, and you know, so at 3 years old, 1879, they're just like, okay, we'll just get another one if he disappears.
Exactly.
We can make more. Like everything about this is, it's, I'm gonna backtrack and say, Rube Waddell is a person who no longer exists in the world. There's not another one like him. If you're gonna go the Hunter S. Thompson route when he's describing Dr. Gonzo, he's like one, you know, like God's rare mutants, too weird to live, too rare to die. That is what this person is, because then you start reading about how in the middle of the game he'd get bored and go fishing, or you know, during baseball games, if he saw a fire truck pass by, he would chase after it. He would disappear for months at a time in the off season. Once it was discovered he was wrestling alligators in the circus. He got easily distracted when other teams would hold up puppies, which would cause him to run over and want to say hi to them. This is a very strange person. Now, one thing I want to make sure I'm clear about, because I don't want to make it sound like I'm making fun of Rube Waddell. There is, you know, obviously there is some degree of, you know, neurodiversity going on that he was not diagnosed back in the day. Also, as you get into it, there's some addiction elements with some great deal of drinking. So I don't want to ever like glamorize this, but there's still something so entirely fascinating about him. And yes, to speak to the drinking, he spent his entire first signing bonus on alcohol. And since he was called a southpaw for being a left-handed pitcher, he was nicknamed Southpaw for his drinking.
Strange combination of like very childlike in so many ways, but also kind of the womanizing drunk that you'd expect a, you know, 1890s baseball player to be.
Right? It's there's something there like where I just would have loved to have been able to be in a room with him and talk to him and see what he was liking. Like when you hear about like the being drawn to puppies and chasing fire trucks, you think one thing, but then you read about how I absolutely love this. And this was from a baseball historian, Lee Allen, said, Waddell began the 1903 season sleeping in a firehouse in Camden, New Jersey, and ended it tending bar in a saloon in Wheeling, West Virginia. In between those events, he won 22 games for the Philadelphia Athletics, toured the nation in a melodrama called The Strain of Guilt, courted and married and became separated from May Wynn Skinner, saved a woman from drowning, accidentally shot a friend through the hand, and was bitten by a lion. But going back to that melodrama he toured the country with, was notable because his co-stars realized he couldn't remember his lines, and they allowed him to improvise. And the show was critically acclaimed, and much was discussed of the scene in which Waddell lifted the actor playing the villain and threw him across the stage with ease. And Waddell used this newfound stardom as an actor to negotiate a higher wage for his baseball career. This is a man who is keyed in. He's not someone who is aloof. He's not a simpleton. He's just shockingly amazing that what he did in between one season is more than most people do in a lifetime.
Exactly. Like, just being bitten by a lion, like, that alone is a story that, like, very few people have lived to
tell about.
And that's like a footnote in this whole thing. You know, obviously no one is recording a play from that era, but like, I would love to see the stain of guilt when he's just improvising everything and the actors around him all have to react almost 100 years before Judd Apatow. Like, I don't think anybody was used to interacting that way on stage.
No, not at all. Like, but the fact that they went with it, it introduces like even a new kind of theater, which leads to.
Like you said, like, the fact that he turned around and was able to negotiate for more money, like, yeah, he wasn't a simpleton. It also just seems like he was extremely interested in a large number of things and just pursued them all at once.
And he had no problem just doing it, which really, again, just is remarkable that he pulls it off. And then he goes in, he gets married multiple times. Most of these marriages are alcohol-induced. At one point, one of his wives tried to sue him for bigamy because she said his previous divorce wasn't valid. And then after he cleared that divorce, he sat down for an interview with the Scranton Republican newspaper for an article called Unkissed Girl Sought by Rube Waddell. And essentially, he was using this interview as a way to find another partner. And in this day and age, you know, if you're a celebrity, you'll have like a management team who can probably set you up on dates. But here he is just going out there. And he's like, I'm going to be in a newspaper and share my intentions that I'm single again.
Well, guess who's back in the market, girls?
Yep. And Ken Burns noted that even Waddell had lost track of how many people he'd married. Which, again, like, I don't want to glamorize misogyny, but there's something just so peculiar in relation to how many other things he was doing.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the fascinating thing about this. Like, there's like, you could make like four different movies with no overlap about this fascinating character.
Yeah. Well, what I keep going back to is I feel like he is, and I'm going to be speaking about the movie, not the book, but he's the anti-Forrest Gump in a way. I have a pretty strong loathing for Forrest Gump, the movie. I know it's a lot to say, but for me, I look at it as, you know, it's the simpleton who falls in line, does what he's told, kills for his country, never questions anything, gets to go to the Olympics and meet the president. And he's contrasted by this free-spirited young girl who marched the beat of her own drummer.
Who just punished
over and over. And dies.
Yeah. It's really just like small-C conservative propaganda.
Yeah.
With a, like, just heavy-handedly manipulative soundtrack.
Exactly. Now, apparently, I mean, the character is pretty different in the book. I've never read it, but he's actually a bit more unlikable, I've heard. And maybe the book version of Forrest Gump was inspired by Rube Waddell. I would not be surprised if I ever talked to that author and he said, well, yeah, I mean, there was people like Rube. So, like, a person like Forrest was completely believable. So that's what I love, you know, in a movie aspect is I want this to be the, you know, the scope of Forrest Gump, but with this non-conservative propaganda twist to
it. Yeah, yeah. But in 13 years, just his playing career, you know, alone, he packs in so much incident. And because he's so erratic, he like moves around from team to team.
Yep. Oftentimes they have to move him because he's getting in fist fights with his teammates. One of my other funny anecdotes back in the era where they had to, teammates had to share rooms, his teammate Ossie Schreckenost refused to share a room until there was a contract clause that said Waddell couldn't eat crackers in bed.
Huh.
And again, I want to know the story. Like, how many crackers are we talking about? And as roommates, were they also sharing a bed? And that's why, or was it just the chewing sound?
Yeah, back then, like, these athletes were not making millions of dollars. They probably were just, you know, two to a bed when they're on the road. Who knows? No. But try to imagine, like, Bryce Harper, you know, filing a complaint with the Phillies, like, because his roommate's eating crackers in bed.
Yeah, or, you know, I'm thinking about that. I believe, see, this is how badly I know sports. I believe the pitcher is Joe Kelly. He's a pitcher who's, like, known for picking fights. He had, like, the Joe Kelly Fight Club as, like, a t-shirt. I think he was on the Red Sox, and he caused a fight with the Astros because he was pissed off at the Astros cheating, so he kept trying to hit the batters. And he's, you know, advocates for, you know, how we got to make baseball wild again. And also, I think, you know, when he's talking about, let's make it like Rube's baseball. But, yeah.
Well, also, one baseball thing that I just kind of love about him. So the rules of baseball, so you have to have 9 men on the field.
Yes.
But especially back in those days, teams would play exhibition games sort of outside the major leagues. They would play barnstorming teams. They would play local teams. And so he would send all of the fielders off the field.
Yeah.
It would just be him and a catcher because he was so confident he could strike out any batter who faced him.
Absolutely. I mean, he was like the second major league pitcher to throw an immaculate inning. I mean, he was talent.
Yeah, yeah. And for the non-sports fans, that's where you just throw 9 strikeouts. Nobody touches the ball. Or not 9 strikeouts, but 9 pitches. Like, 9 strikes, 9 strikeouts, you know. Yeah, and he was considered, like, one of the fastest fastballs in the league. But then also had, like, a screwball and a flutterball and a fadeaway and all these trick pitches that they don't even use anymore. Like, he wasn't just, like, a big, dumb, like, lunkhead with a strong arm. He also had, like, a lot of finesse and, you know, there's a lot of psychology to pitching.
Yeah.
And again, it kind of belies, like, he had these sort of childlike fascinations, but he also seems to have been, I don't know, like a guy with a lot going on in his mind.
I would let him negotiate a contract for me. Like, he could be my real estate agent.
I mean, you'd probably end up owning the team. Who knows?
Yeah. He could be my accountant. You know, I would give this guy a shot. Also, I trust him to save my life. Like, also, there's a time where, like, a burning oil stove tipped over in a department store, and he carried it outside before it could start a larger fire in the department store. This guy was just like, I'm going to act. In my mind, it's all, you know, inherent instinct. Like, this is, like, if there's something wrong, I'm going to go try to help. I'm going to go jump in. And then also, he's just someone who's going to say, yes, I'm going to appreciate the puppies, or I'm going to go fishing.
Yeah, he just seems like somebody who, like, lived life to the fullest.
Yeah.
I also think in terms of, like, leaving a baseball game in the middle of it to go fishing, like, Major League Baseball was not the multi-billion dollar enterprise that it is today. You know, he might have had a different set of priorities than somebody who this was their lifelong dream and their livelihood and, you know, paying them millions of dollars. If it's just like, yeah, this is a fun thing. Ooh, there's a more fun thing. I'm going to go do that.
I would absolutely love it. I mean, that would get me to a baseball game, is knowing the potential that a player might just be like, screw this, I'm going fishing. Or I got to go catch a movie. Like, that would make, I mean, it's chaos, but it's the kind of chaos I'm drawn to.
Oh, yeah. I actually kind of want a double header a double feature of Rube Waddell. And we earlier guest did a baseball episode, but kind of mentioned in passing Old Hoss Radbourne, who has one of the best names in old-timey baseball.
Yeah.
And to this day holds the records for wins by a pitcher because the other starting pitcher on his team was injured. And rather than sign another one, he just pitched all of the games. And, like, this would destroy, you know, your entire body if you did try to do that today. And somehow, like, he pitched, like, sometimes every day he pitched 2 games of a doubleheader. Like, it was just this insane level of commitment. And almost the opposite of Rube Waddell, who, like, didn't take this sort of sport seriously enough. He just took it way too seriously. And they were both just intense weirdos.
Absolutely.
Who also were alcoholics and died young tragically. And
oh, yeah. Can we also mention that Rube died at age 37 of, like, complications from, it seems like, pneumonia and tuberculosis. But yeah, he did all this before he was 37.
Do you want to tell the backstory of the pneumonia, or should I? Because the Wikipedia...
Oh, please. I would love to hear you tell it.
Well, this is from the Wikipedia, so we don't have enough detail here, but it says, well, in spring training, he played 13 years in the majors, but he continued to play in the minors as some, you know, past their prime players do. In the middle of spring training with a minor league team, Waddell helped save the city of Hickman, Kentucky from a devastating flood in the spring of 1912. I have no idea how he did this. History does not seem to record this. I don't know if he just like flew in with a bunch of sandbags like Superman.
That's what
like,
I'm thinking. He's just carrying sandbags in.
Yeah. But in doing that, in stopping this flood and saving this town somehow, he got pneumonia. And I'm quoting Wikipedia here. Catching pneumonia, he lost much of the vitality that sustained him. And a second flood in Hickman and another ensuing case of pneumonia in 1913 took the rest. So in two consecutive years, this town in Kentucky floods. And in both years, Waddell helps stop the save people from the flood and gets pneumonia. And it could very well be that it's like a Hurricane Katrina situation where he's like in the water pulling people out and getting them to safety.
Yeah.
Which probably makes the most sense because if he caught pneumonia. But like he got pneumonia that seems to have really taken a toll on him. And the following year, he was like, they need my help. I'm doing it again. And then that the same year he got pneumonia for the second time, somehow he goes from Kentucky to Minneapolis and is diagnosed with tuberculosis there, and then moves to San Antonio, Texas to recover living with his sister. He never recovered and died the year after that.
It's funny because it's him. I have no, like, I don't even question, like, Kentucky, Minneapolis, Texas. I'm like, okay, yeah, that's him. He's on the road again. Doesn't matter.
Exactly. Like, even by the standards of baseball players who travel around, like in, you know, any article you read about him, like in every sentence, he's in a different place or playing for a different team or like, and then all these jobs, what was the thing where he like started the season working in a firehouse and ended up bartending bar in like a different state?
Exactly. I mean, and I don't know. There's something just magical about this person, you know, despite the peculiarities and despite, you know, the alcoholism and.
Another job that I'm reading about, it said to make sure he stayed out of trouble during the offseason, Browns owner Robert Hedges hired him as a hunter over the winters of 1908 and 1909. Like, do you know anything about this? Like, was he just like, go out and get me some deer?
Probably. I mean, I'm assuming he was like a full process guy. He'd kill it, skin it, cut up the meat, you know, treat the skin, make some blanket. Like,
make it into a coat, yeah.
Yeah, I think he did sense. Everything. So I guess all this is to say is, this is probably one of the last folk heroes we can have.
Yeah, yeah.
To keep it topical with today and everyone talking about Oppenheimer, I really liked when he was referred to by one of his team managers that he was the atom bomb of baseball before the atom bomb was discovered. And I like to think that the world is irrevocably changed and there can be no more folk heroes after the atomic bomb. And so he's the last of them, or one of the last.
And that quote comes from Connie Mack, who...
Connie Mack, that's right.
I think if we're doing a movie, that's kind of the only other significant character who returns, because Connie Mack was like legendary baseball manager, and he lived a very, very long time. He was managing baseball in the 1890s, and he lived long enough to see the atomic bomb and give that quote. But he seemed like somebody who really believed in Waddell and like kept bringing him back, and also kind of knew how to handle him. Like, actually, I was saying Old House Radbourne pitched both games of a doubleheader, which is a punishing, you know, day for a baseball pitcher. Waddell also pitched the first game of a doubleheader when he was playing for Milwaukee, and Connie Mack was his manager. And he not only pitched a 17-inning game, he also won it by hitting a triple.
Yep.
Because he was also a pretty good hitter. You know, 90 years before Shohei Ohtani is like, you know, leading the home run charts and pitching. But Connie Mack needed him to pitch the second game after pitching against a 17-inning game. And so he offered him a 3-day fishing vacation, and he said yes. And then he threw a shutout for the second game. This might be a little bit of color, but this article makes it sound like he like left the stadium and went to the lake.
I mean, in the movie version, that is what would happen. Like, for a dramatic effect, he's just going to like get his fishing gear from the dugout and just walk to a car.
Oh, and I left out the framing of this story where he's pitching for the Milwaukee Brewers because the Pittsburgh Pirates had signed him and his behavior was so erratic they suspended him. And so he was kind of pitching like semi-pro, was like out of baseball, and Connie Mack found he was available. So he called Pittsburgh and said, you don't want this guy, can I borrow him? And so while under contract for the Pirates, he played for the Brewers, pitched, let's see, 17 plus 9, pitched 26 innings in a day, and the Pirates found out about this, that he won both games of a doubleheader, and they were like, okay, we want him back. And then the following year, Pittsburgh was sick of him again and sent him to the Cubs. And then, yeah, he wore out his welcome with the Cubs. He was in a minor league team called the Los Angeles Lulus. And there's some great
Los Angeles Lulus. Like, I want to hear the history of that team now.
Oh, I know. There's one of my favorite websites is a t-shirt emporium, I guess, called Ebbets Field Flannels. They only sell shirts from like defunct sports teams. And so there are a lot of wild minor league baseball teams, including the Hannibal, Missouri Cannibals. If they don't have a Los Angeles Lulus shirt, they will. And that's one thing I love about minor league baseball. That continues today because there's like the Hartford Yard Goats and the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs. This wasn't their real name, but a team renamed themselves the Rocket City Trash Pandas and had a raccoon for their mascot for a little while.
Oh, that's amazing.
I feel like the Staten Island Yankees. That's right. The Staten Island Yankees were the Staten Island Pizza Rats for like half a season.
Really?
Just to celebrate the internet meme.
Printing like new jerseys for half a season. That's dedication. I appreciate that.
Oh, this was another story. Like, not only did he perform these remarkable like baseball feats in between getting thrown off of one team and another, Connie Mack was also like a big enough believer in this guy that Connie Mack ended up managing a football team. The Oakland A's were originally in Philadelphia, and they had a football team also called the Philadelphia Athletics, which Connie Mack also managed. Again, it was 1902. They were like, man, you're good at one sport, you can do them all. And so he recruited Waddell to play for the Athletics football team. He never played, I'm quoting Connie Mack here. There was a little fellow from Wanamakers who asked for the job at quarterback. I don't think he weighed more than 140 pounds. Well, the first practice, Waddell tackled and broke his leg. It was the first inkling John and I had the players could be badly hurt in football. Because, unfortunately, we found this out many, many times over since then. But we got Rube out of there without delay. He was supposed to be pretty good. We never found out. And the thing is, in today's NFL, they'd probably be like, give this guy a bonus. Sign him up.
Yeah.
Waddell himself was undeterred because he just went back to his family home in Pennsylvania and just played with local, like, semi-pro football teams there. And he also had a brief stint as a goalkeeper in the St. Louis Soccer League.
Of course he did.
And it seems less of like, Michael Jordan assigned to take a break and play baseball as like, hey, you're up for a game? I'll go play anything you want me to.
I mean, this is like Bo knows, but it's like Rube knows.
Exactly. Except he played each of these sports for like a week and then got thrown out.
Yes. So, I mean, I can't believe they haven't made this film yet.
And even that, like, I don't think he's that well remembered by sort of baseball or baseball fans.
He
is in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, but from 1946. Like.
Yeah, he was elected in 1946, so he's not like people are still necessarily talking about this guy.
I was pretty happy when I was took my son to the Baseball Hall of Fame and saw his name. I'm like, that one I know.
Yeah. So for this, sort of anti-Forrest Gump, who do you see directing it?
Oh, man, I want someone quirky directing it. I don't necessarily need someone who does like sports pictures or anything like that.
That's my thing about it. You really want this to be a character study about this compellingly odd guy. You don't want to do like a glossy biopic, and you don't want to do like a rah-rah sports movie where he wins the big game in the end. It really has to be like baseball has to be the backdrop, very much backgrounded, and it really has to be just the force of this guy's personality.
Yeah, so I would, I would find someone who this is not appropriate for it, but it's like where my mind went, like the Safdie brothers, like who did Uncut Gems. Like,
I could kind of see that.
Yeah, if they want to do a period piece, or like the Coen brothers when they were younger, if they wanted to do this. They would bring out like the real ridiculousness of the humor. They've never done anything based on a true story, I don't think.
Yeah, I think despite the disclaimer at the beginning of Fargo.
Yes, exactly.
And they've never done a sports movie. It'd be very interesting to see what their take on a sports movie would be.
But also, this is going to be a left field or whatever. I don't know my sports metaphors thing. But Richard Linklater, I think, could really knock this out of the park. And there we go. But I think he has that eccentric appreciation for Americana. I'm gonna say is right away when you look at how he's doing a snapshot of the 70s and Days Confused and the way he captured boyhood in the early 21st century. He has, and then he did that Western, which was not very good, but it was one of those, you know, one for you, one for me pictures, the for Newton sure. Boys, which is based on a true story. But, you know, like the movie looked good. And
also he seems like kind of enough of a dude that he'd be a sports guy and would understand the baseball side of it, but also enough of an indie filmmaker to not foreground the baseball stuff. And also like Dazed and Confused and like Slacker are kind of just Shaggy Dog, yeah, like hangout movies. And that's kind of what you want. You just want him sort of stumbling from one wild incident to the next.
Absolutely. Oh, and yeah. But speaking of which, he does have baseball credits. He did the another one he did for the studio was the Bad News Bears remake.
I forgot he directed that. Yeah.
And he can do crowd pleasers like School of Rock.
I mean, he's such a versatile director, and he comes up a lot on this show because he can do so many things.
Yeah.
Well, the only name I had on my list was Kelly Reichardt.
Oh.
Because besides, you know, she's one of our best directors, but all of her films are character studies about idiosyncratic people who are slightly out of step with society in like one way or another.
Yeah.
And so that just seems like if you want to focus on not who this guy is as a baseball player, but who this guy is as a person and why he's interesting and why he doesn't gel with everybody around him, I feel like that's all the stories that she's interested in.
Absolutely. That is a phenomenal pick. Huh. Think about the job if she wants to call us.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, email whyisitnotamovie@gmail.com.
Yeah.
it's funny. It's fun like pretending that we're really going to make this movie.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
because I said this in the last episode too, but I have some guests who are like, I know this actor has been dead for 40 years, but, and then I have some guests who are like, can we get this guy for this made-up movie?
Okay, so I am going to ask, let's skip to the lead then.
Yeah.
I'm almost embarrassed now because I always forget his name. You know, he now stars on The Bear. Is it Jeremy Allen White? Is that his name?
Oh, yeah.
Jeremy Allen White, star of The Bear and previously on Shameless. He's going to be, you know, a little bit old for this, but even when you go look at like a picture of Rube when he was doing the math in my head, 24 years old, he looks like he's in his late 30s.
It was the 1890s and he was a hard drinker. Like everybody in there, every 24-year-old looked like he was a 50-year-old today.
Absolutely. So if I was casting this today, it would be him to go to if the person was still alive. In a minute, this would have been Anton Yelchin's movie.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I love Anton Yelchin, and he had a great career. I think this could have been his showstopper of a movie where it pushed him over into the next sphere.
Yeah. I had my, like, too old and my age appropriate because if Michael Shannon weren't too old for this.
Yes.
He excels at playing super intense weirdos, but he's just also got the right physicality to play this guy who like breaks a quarterback's leg on the first play. And
I've seen him on the subway. He's a big guy.
Yeah. And looking at just pictures of Rube Waddell, he's like, he's this big lantern jawed kind of hulking guy, but he's also, I think he's probably in his 50s at this point. So it's stretching it a little bit. So I was trying to think of like who was younger and I came with Will Poulter. He's also like a big guy with like square jawed, who's believable as an athlete. He's 30, but he's so young enough looking. He could kind of play him at all points in the story. And despite being kind of a big, like jock looking guy, like his roles in like We're the Millers and Guardians of the Galaxy 3, like he can play an intense oddball.
Yeah. Really well.
And so I think he could be good for this too.
Okay. I'd sign on with that in a second. If it came between him and Jeremy Allen White, we might have to like have a coin toss, but
I mean, I think White's just somebody who's like at the top of his acting game right now. And like,
yeah, he's got this weird intensity and I just think he could disappear into the role.
Yeah, I know. I think he's the guy. I just didn't think of him.
Yeah. But although, okay. Now speaking of disappearing into roles though. So I'm a big Andrew Garfield fan. And when I was seeing him in Tick, Tick, Boom, I was shocked how he just inhabited the character and I didn't recognize him at all. Like, I like him and I think he is versatile, but like when I see him in Never Let Me Go, I see some of the same quirks he has in Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah.
But he shocked me in Tick, Tick, Boom, where I did not see him at all. I only saw this, you know, this real life person he was portraying. And, you know, he's, you know, probably getting too old to do this, but he could have been a great, like, Rube throughout, you know, the years.
Yeah, I could see that. Like, and I know, like, that's the thing that actors do is play different roles and be different people. And yet when somebody does it really well, and because so many actors do have like a sort of a persona or a wheelhouse where they do one thing well. And so when somebody does just play a completely different type than you've seen them before, and you kind of forget it's them, like that just, that wows me every time. Especially like the thing I'm a big sucker for is if the same actor plays like two very different personalities in the same thing and they switch back and forth. I'm like, oh my God, like, even though that's the whole job of acting. So did you have anybody else who like needs to be cast in this? I don't know if there's any other significant characters because he bounces from team to team and place to place and wife to wife. So you can either kind of, you know, spend 3 hours breaking down all these small characters, or you can just say, we're going to get a bunch of good character actors and fill out these roles.
Yeah. I mean, I think you brought up a good point about Connie Mack. I think Connie Mack would be like a critical character to have in this film version. And, you know, this is a film, so I'm fine fudging details and fudging timeline and finessing events to work a narrative if that's what's going to suit the film version of this. It doesn't have to tell the complete truth. Yeah, so yeah. I would be okay with even, you know, bumping up Connie Mack in a way, but I don't know. Like, I figure I'm going to kick that over to you. I figure you probably have some people in mind who could play Connie Mack really well.
Yeah, I didn't have anybody who I thought was like just dead on, but I came with Matthew Reese mostly just because like he's got an old timey face, maybe just because I'm thinking this from seeing him in the Perry Mason weird prequel.
Yeah.
Where he's kind of in this era. But mostly just because he's great in everything. And he's kind of about the right age and about the right like type. So one more thing about Connie Mack while we're talking about him is that I've heard about this guy my whole life as just one of the important figures in early baseball. But I only learned for the first time while researching for this podcast his full name was Cornelius McGillicuddy, which is just wonderful. But I do agree that, like, I think he needs to be sort of the secondary figure because you need somebody kind of grounding Rube.
And you know who could do it? Just looking at Connie Mack photos is Mark Rylance.
Oh, yeah.
He was Bridge of Spies, and he's a really strong character actor. But I think he would just sink right into the, you know, when I'm looking at this hat and the suit that.
He's interesting too because he was like a top tier like theater actor, like his generation's Olivier, who did not do TV or film, and then Christopher Nolan convinced him to do Dunkirk, and then now he's like, okay, I'll do TV and film.
Yeah, and he's knocking it out. Like, I mean, he was in Bones and All, right? Like that was him.
Yeah,
and that's him. Like, I was so unnerved by his performance in that.
And that's the thing, like, he is just, like, a capital A actor, as much as anybody alive. And so, yeah, I mean, I think you can kind of cast him for anything, but I also think he's kind of the right fit for this. So, yeah, that's a great choice.
Everyone else, yeah, just bring different people in, move them out. Like, if we could even, I mean, it wouldn't happen in this day and age of movies, but to even just have that sort of slacker, dazed and confused, like, Shaggy Dog narrative, like that would be so much fun, like where you just kind of just fall into the rhythm of the movie and it's not really about a singular plot or arc.
And also, even if you don't have the Coens directing, like get their casting director on board here, because they're so good at like just stuffing their movies with just interesting character actors who bring the no small actors thing.
If not for Connie Mack, it was for some, just put Tim Blake Nelson in there somewhere. He belongs in this movie.
Actually, I think could be good as Mack too.
Yeah,
but there's so many other players and managers, and like Steven Root's got to be in there somewhere. And
yes, I want to see Mia Goth as one of the wives because
that'd be good. Yeah,
Mia Goth is one of like the most exciting actresses right now. So yeah,
lot of the fan casting on the show is just like, this is somebody I love who's doing great work right now.
Exactly.
You know, put him in more movies.
So with that regard, I want to say Rian Johnson could also really direct this well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think Rian Johnson could direct anything well.
Yeah. Very true. Good counterpoint. Yeah, no, I think he would, you know, cast the hell out of this movie. Okay, now I got an idea. You're going to roll your eyes at, I hope.
Go on.
For Connie Mack, Ben Affleck.
Huh.
You know, current Ben Affleck, you know, he's skinny. He's got some mileage on his face.
Yeah, yeah. And he's also kind of, he's like, now that he's slimmed down, he's kind of got that wiriness of like a, you know, like a former athlete. Because yeah. I also, looking at pictures of Connie Mack online, you see pictures of him from like the early, you know, mid-20th century when he was like in his 60s and 70s. And I forget, like, I mean, he's still a pretty young guy. He's like, his playing career is not that far behind him. So you don't want somebody who's like that, you know, you don't want somebody in their 50s necessarily. Yeah, and I think, I think you want somebody who like, he's kind of hard-assed enough to, you know, manage an old-timey baseball team full of a bunch of drunks who get into fistfights, but also can kind of, you know, is sort of thoughtful enough and compassionate enough to see something in Rube and like give him second and third and fourth chances.
Yeah.
That kind of works. Yeah. And also, frankly, like he kind of needs more roles that let him act.
Absolutely. Like when he acts, he's fantastic. I'm a big, you know, I've always been a fan of his, but just dawning me now, I'm like, oh yeah, he could do this.
And I feel like he's coming out of a phase where he was making really good choices as a director and really poor choices as an actor. And he's finally kind of starting to do interesting work again, as, you know, in front of the camera.
Did you see the Ridley Scott movie, The Last Duel, with him and Adam Driver and Matt Damon?
Yeah, no, I actually didn't, but I heard he was terrific in that.
He was just he was just doing scenery, and like he understood the assignment and had one of like the best line readings of the decade, which I'm not even going to attempt to emulate. But I mean, the movie is what it is. It's not like something groundbreaking, but it was better than it looked from the trailers, I'll say that. And yeah, just Affleck, you know, he was originally going to play the Adam Driver part, but they found out they could get Adam Driver, and so he took this smaller character instead and just owned it.
And not a lot of actors, you know, have the lack of ego to do that.
Yeah.
Adam Driver is much better than I am at this. Like,
exactly.
You know, that takes something. And I also, the thing that I heard about the movie was like putting Affleck and Damon together in something just feels like stunt casting, even though they wrote it and it was their idea.
Yeah.
And yet, like, no, they just really inhabit these characters and are both good choices for it.
So to tie back to baseball, do you know there was like two baseball professional players in the 70s who decided to like swap wives and families?
That's definitely another Wise Is Not a Movie.
Yeah. Well, it nearly was with Affleck and Damon, like in their post Good Will Hunting days. That something that they were pursuing. I don't know whatever happened to it, other than just it didn't happen. But yeah, that one almost was a movie with the two of them.
I feel like they need to pull a Superbad and just say like, hey, we're too old to make this movie, but we're just going to find younger actors and make the thing we wanted to make for ourselves.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
because that's the thing. We could do a whole season on like 70s baseball. This podcast came out of a column I did for the AV Club called Wiki Wormhole, where I would write about odd Wikipedia pages, which was really just turned into an excuse for me to tell like cool stories.
Yeah.
And I'm actually kind of surprised I never got to Rube Waddell, because I did a couple baseball ones. One of them was a scandal where there was a cocaine sort of ring in the 80s, and the ringleader was the Pittsburgh Pirates mascot, who was selling cocaine out of the giant parrot head, and like visiting teams would like come to Pittsburgh, and the mascot would like reach inside the head and like give him a baggie of coke and like, you know, give Reggie Jackson some coke or somebody. And a lot of the players got a slap on the wrist, but the parrot went to jail. I think they did make a movie about Doc Ellis pitching a no-hitter on LSD pretty recently. I think Amazon might have done that one. Like, there's so many great stories about 70s baseball that you could tell.
So basically what we need, maybe instead of a series of movies, and this is completely contradictory to your podcast, but maybe we need like an anthology TV series, like, you know, like Ryan Murphy doing the American Horror Stories, where every season is a different wild baseball story over 6 to 10 episodes.
Oh, yeah. It'd be like kind of like semi-fictional 30 for 30, where you just focus
on
the same. To be honest, on the podcast, there's very often a movie or limited series.
Yeah. That's, I think it's got to be. And, you know, and then to go to the Coen brothers angle of the way that the Fargo TV series jumps around the decades and are not really related but have slight overlaps. Absolutely. So you could have Rube Waddell in one season and then a 70s parrot in the next.
And also there are, like, you can do overlaps.
Yeah.
You can make this like a shared universe because it's the real world where these people did live in the same world, because I'm sure, like, the wife swapping 70s players probably played in games where the parrot was dealing coke.
Absolutely.
And Connie Mack was a manager for decades and probably was involved in weird baseball stories in the 20s and the 40s. And, like, I like that a lot.
Yeah. We are the shared universe. Like,
that's exactly. That. Yeah.
Right. Greenlit. It's done.
Right. So that's our movie. Thanks again to Randall Lotowitz. Look for the DC Book of Lists, Superhero Playbook, and his other books at your local independent bookstore. If you have any thoughts on old-timey baseball, fire trucks, or ideas for movies that need to get made, hit me up on Blue Sky at Mike Vago. And you can read student journalism, hear college radio, and listen to other lesser podcasts on our parent website, subjectmedia.org. We'll be back in 2 weeks with the next episode on
Why is this not a movie?